So up first to introduce Tana Welch is Laura Miner.
Hey, welcome. Welcome to the Jerome Stern Reading Series. Who is Tana Jean Welch? And what has she done? She is the author of Latest Volcano, winner of the 2015 Marsh Hawk Press Poetry Prize. Her poems have appeared in journals including the Southern Review, the Gettysburg Review, Prairie Schooner, and the Colorado Review. Born and raised in Fresno, California, she currently lives in Tallahassee, where she is assistant professor of medical humanities at the Florida State University College of Medicine. Which reminds me of a regularly featured question in a hip magazine I used to read. How did you get that cool fucking job? When writing these things, you often think, you know, how do others feel about Tana? Supporters and fans of Tana Jean Welch have called her book ruthless and relentless. And I couldn't agree more. But it sneaks up on you. Our own Aaron Ballou, Tana's mentor here at FSU, said of her work, "It's full of precision and intensity, and it's always full of surprises. You never know what she's going to say or think in the poems. I enjoy them very much." Sandra Alcocer blurbs, "In the way that the poet HD gathered long-scattered mythic shards to bring vision to a shattered world, Tana Jean Welch creates her own mythology, metamorphic and sensuous, and elegant poems that have the power to terrify, to fill one with awe, as the poet attempts to pin down exactly where the human soul resides." And Alberto Rios writes, "These are not words that shout, but they are poems that lead us to their moment." In a Rain Taxi review, Greg Bim wrote, "Each poem in this dense volume is lyrically defined by both narrative structure and holistic convergence of abstract and concrete. The presentation of characters, settings, and situations is as subtly beautiful as it is haunting and leaves the reader inspired and in awe. These poems are guilt-lined." And finally, in Tupelo Quarterly, Anne Champion nails it, really, when she wrote of Tana's work, "Are sex and pleasure only a way for us to combat our grief about the havoc of the world? Is it a form of ignorance, of apathy, of healing? Whatever it is, war and sex are yoked together. One cannot be seen as separate from the other. Destruction doesn't exist if not for our own acts of creation." And I guess this is how I feel about Tana's work. I liked it because it's challenging, and I can't predict the psychology of any given poem on the page. In fact, it's a little terrifying in the way that it forced me to slow down, and I tend to go fast. To take in that language first, and then the images, which are so sensual, it makes you feel like you've never read the word pearl before. And then the complexity of relationships as told by some omniscient terrestrial magician. She made me want to put a scorpion, in my poem, because scorpions are cool. And there are dragons, centaurs, sea goats, daggers and skullcaps, and an 88 Camaro. Sure, it does a great job of connecting the animal world of pain with death, darkness, grief, the violence of women's bodies, ritualism, mysticism, binaries, and the like, but it also has an 88 Camaro, which we just realized was misspelled in the first pressing today. So buy a copy tonight because it might go up in value and you can get it signed, and she's really good at signing books, so please buy one. Tana is the only other person I know to write a poem for Deborah Diggs. It felt like someone putting a warm hand to your chest when you need it. The interiority of her mind and world speaks of pain, loss, and remembrance, as if revealed by a shy celestial clerk transcribing the world's cruel delivery system of death. The thing about Tana's book is that it makes me want to fall back in love with someone who I don't want to remember anymore. Perhaps someone I forgot how to love or loved poorly, which did feel relentless upon impact. Because it's the looking back that we all fear, right? Having to find your own relentlessness and not turn away. Please join me in welcoming Tana Jean Welch to the stage.
Thank you, Laura. Not sure I can live up to that intro, but I will try. Okay, so the first poems I'm going to read are from the first section of Latest Volcano, and that's a sort of narrative sequence of 12 poems about a girl whose father died in a motorcycle accident when she was young, and she was sexually assaulted shortly thereafter. And she blames her mother for both of these incidents, and so she spends her life angry, running away often on the road. The first poem, How Much Poison? She's collecting scorpions, getting them before they get her, in the attic, in the bathtub. She finds the tiny toxic lobsters laced between her bed sheets, lets them loose at the base of the lemon tree, starts the game over, one by one until the box is full. The scorpion is her sigil, her love song on the battlefield, her war cry in the senseless fields. Survive on nothing, on one insect a year. Dagger your tail, desert dweller. Peel the bark. Hold it to your mother's throat. Ask her why there is no grave to visit. Nothing to tap and touch. Hello, I miss you. Not even an urn with your father's ashes. She took the gun. She took the gun and walked to the reservoir behind the stitched line of tracked homes. She always knew the pearl-handled revolver was under her mother's bed, could sometimes hear it breathing on the nights she couldn't sleep. Stepping out of the shadows of hackberry, red oak, she arrived at the water's edge and found no clouds in the reflection. Blank sky, no shield, nothing between her and the blue universe, the loud sun, but blood is never brightness. And today there was blood on her underwear for the first time, and the girl knew she wouldn't tell her mother, not now, maybe never, because her mother would say it was something. And the girl knew it was nothing, felt like nothing, just like the gun in her hand wasn't heavy or cold, just like shooting into the water felt like nothing, until two fish rose to the surface, mouths gaping open like children singing in the midnight choir, paper wings wired to their backs, or like children in a furnace, stomachs bloated and empty. And the next one, the girl thinks she might turn to religion to help her with her situation. Nothing to see here. The girl takes a bus across town to the Pont de Vida and buys a rosary. On the return trip, she crimps the brown beads in her palm and pretends she is a Catholic. She imagines herself on pilgrimage to Köln, peering into the hearts of 11,000 virgins. She wants to see the arsenal of ribs, shoulder blades, and femurs, the riot of relics resting in the basilica. Pray to St. Ursula's martyred handmaids. Touch the skull caps of 20 virgins, say 10 Hail Marys, and you get to start over. Her body unspoiled, her body never pressed against damp dirt in a wide field, blue-stemmed grass waving a secret fortress around bare skin. She imagines a priest feeding her apple strudel, wrapping her in red cloth. She ponders the logistics of beheading 11,000 girls. How many Huns did it take? How much blood? How long? Okay, the last one I'll read from this sequence is written in the voice of the runaway. Horse-driven men. I can use my body to straddle or save the universe, to be a soft animal for a man or woman who knows how to touch and travel the surface of my quiet skin, how to span the bridge. It's all right to miss my mother, and I do when I see the lemon tree in the courtyard, when I pick one to slice through. I see sugar drops, but no ditch reeds, no scorpions in sight. Once, I cried a thrum of tears. I surveyed the stars like when Dad died, our backs to the grass, sucking on rum lifesavers, red vines, my mother and I gazing at the lost centaur, who succumbed to a brilliant loss of control and scattered his armor from pole to pole. I'll have to drink a lot of water. I get dry mouth for some reason when I'm nervous. So as Laura said so well in her introduction, for me, the book is about the tension between war and love, creation and destruction. So several of the poems are about artists or their artwork. And it's not really ekphrastic so much as I'm interested in the life surrounding the art piece or the events surrounding the art piece. So this poem that I'm going to read next is about one of Gustav Klimt's paintings that was destroyed when the Nazis burnt down Immendorf Palace in 1945, his painting of Lita and the Swan. It's called Lita Burning. The SS soldier strikes his match on Lita's bare back. The lecherous swan's black neck sinks into the curve of her ass. The flesh quivers as the fire follows her spine to the nape, to the hollow. Fingers blister as the gold leaf in her hair curls into layers of pitch-dark roses. And the painted bed swirls in melted hues of green before sucking Lita's last breast into gray ash, soot. And sweet young thing, sighs the soldier. This one's about the painter. It's not about her. I guess it is. It's about the painter Alice Neal and two portraits she painted of Frank O'Hara. Getting your work before the world. Frank O'Hara's teeth looked like tombstones the second time Alice Neal painted his face on canvas, capturing the freckles on his forehead. It was because he was beat, she said. The lilacs in the background were withered and Frank O'Hara was beat. The trouble came from love of any kind. Alice knew this trouble like she knew what shade to paint the downturned look of the Haitian woman holding her dead child, like she knew to blend her own grief in the color of stewed turnips and to wear violet when listening to her shrink, a man who spent hours lecturing. Many men in history have had mistresses, but I don't think any got paintings as an extra bonus. And O'Hara himself knew there were never enough words, never enough orange, always a lack of orange to complete the picture, the image, the soda, the park, the half-dressed man. Not even enough to add any citrus at all. No tangerines, no tangelos. Alice agreed. The man kissing the back of your neck was never the right one. So she went to her married lover's apartment and claimed all that was hers, all she'd given from inside, hauled each canvas up the littered yellow street. The second time Frank O'Hara came to her door, discarded and unmet by any man in the park, he looked beat, no longer the romantic falcon. Alice painted him this way, sitting against the backdrop of dead lilacs, his face a plague of indents, a factory of fatigue, to express his trouble, to express the loss of what so many of us give and never remember to collect. The speaker of this next poem is a witness to the Oklahoma City bombing, and the poem takes place that day. It's called Trees. My grandfather once explained how the seed of the giant sequoia is as small and light as an oat flake. only taking wind when the flames have cleared the earth. Somehow he always finds me in the midst of the great fires, like the one outside my office window breeding a ballet of falling ash, quiet dross settling over debris, a silence already filled with noise. I can't hear anymore but see how the firemen gathering broken children turn into my grandfather, tying splints to new saplings. And the broad-shouldered elm shading the parked but burning cars is my grandfather trimming the bamboo in his garden. And the asphalt exploded, gashing the girth of its trunk, is the shrapnel scars lining his legs. He would have loved this 80-year-old elm tree in front of the hollowed-out federal building, half its limbs alight, for the same reason he loved the sequoias, the value of perennial beauty, the way they stand patiently, an army of monstrous Buddhas, for 100 years, and then 100 more. The world is on fire, and all I can see is my grandfather's backyard, his trees, the peach and orange, the nectarine he'd kept for decades, tending its thin branches, despite its sterile belly, its lack of seed. Okay, the last two poems, they can take place at any time and at any space. Fortification. George, the man whose penis I sometimes hold, has brought me to this old Austro-Hungarian spa town surrounded by high mountain stone. A place to hide from his battalion, the war, my spouse. A place to look up from the valley to the cliffs and imagine an army of husbands running, then suddenly stop short. Under the issued white terry cloth cowl, I am Magdalena, or the Madonna, and George is my Hieronymus, or the bishop. Together we move from fountain to fountain, clutching our blue ceramic cups. The metallic water is thick and salinic, like ejaculate. In this water, we swim under marble ceilings, like manatees. We swim 1 inch beyond extinction. All but one cafe has been closed, so the patients, the solitary doctor, the left-behind women, and Boris, the masseur who says he's too old to fight, all of us, all eat together. When George skips his shave, arrives at tea with a dark-shadowed jaw, Boris complains and sings propriety like my mother-in-law hisses when her sons wear their hats to dinner. But this was before her sons were old enough to march. Before I learned to love the 5 o'clock shadow, before I knew George's face stubble in concert with his tongue, licking my pink, licking my labia, gives me great pleasure. Who is Boris to deny pleasure? Who is anyone to deny pleasure? We soak in mud and nurse ourselves with minerals and milk while on the other side of the mountain, the bodies of 1,000 men, husbands and fathers, are cracking open. Because we are sick, we can only drink our water and pretend not to hear. One more. Ad infinitum. The sex was never ending and beautiful like a billion poppies blowing over the graves and empty houses, and the explosion in the distance was beautiful like a billion poppies blowing toward the east trying to escape the west, and the explosion in the distance worked in our favor as you bent me over toward the east, trying to escape the west, and the pounding, working in our favor as you bent me over, like thunder and rain, a black blizzard, a charged sky, and the pounding, like an orgasm to wake all neighboring armies, like thunder and rain, a black blizzard, a charged sky. I heard myself coming until my throat was sore, like an orgasm to wake all neighboring armies, or the hard slap on a woman's round ass. I heard myself coming until my throat was sore from screaming over the loud machines or the hard slap on a woman's round ass committed by a soldier on leave, a soldier gone AWOL, from screaming over the loud machines, saving his supply of butter and cinnamon for my nipples, suckled by a soldier on leave, a soldier gone AWOL, the one missing two fingers, licking his supply of butter and cinnamon from my nipples, because this is how we keep going. The one missing two fingers, pulling apart our clothes under the battle-broken sky, because this is how we keep going. Like the atom eternally splitting, pulling apart our clothes under the century-long sky. The sex was never ending, like the atom eternally splitting over the graves and empty houses. Thanks.